Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to another episode of Rahulla Stapur. My guest this week is probably best known for playing the hairy bus in Aqua Teen Hunger Force. It's Doug Stanhope. Here he is. Which I don't know what that is. I picked it out. I love the sound of it. It sounds good. What was the hairy bus in Aqua Teen Hunger Force? It sounds like
it's like stoner TV. I don't know. I just did a voiceover, but it's funny because my regular opener in the States, Junior Stopka, on this last tour, just keeps finding my most obscure things like that. So. Yeah. He introduces me. He was on season 2 of Spy TV, and he was the hairy bus.
It's good. It's fun. Well, you know, you get some interest because people never talk about their minor credits, so you often get something interesting out of that. But look, you are
I forget them, Richard, and occasionally yes. I'll go on IMDb to see what I've done with my life, and I go, oh shit, I forgot about that.
Yeah, well, a lot of people do, and certainly as we're almost exactly the same age, Doug, and I forget what happened 2 days ago now. I write a blog every day. If I don't write it the day after, I can't remember what the fuck I did 2 days ago. So that's so I
love it when people that don't drink that are my age forget, because I'm like, all right, because I'd blame the booze otherwise, but nah, it's just part of aging.
Well, I did drink a lot. I've only just stopped drinking. I've stopped drinking for the last couple of years, so it hasn't improved my memory, I have to say, stopping drinking. But I think maybe I did the damage in my 30s and 40s and 20s. Look, so it's a great time for you to come over to the UK on tour. You're currently in Dublin, I understand, which where the reaction to the death of Queen Elizabeth might be slightly different than here in the United Kingdom. So don't lose
I've only been getting filled in just now by Brian Hennigan, my manager.
Yeah. So I don't think
it was trending on Twitter. What were they saying?
Here we go.
I don't get it at all. But okay. God's trying to cock block this whole tour. All these dates were booked in 2020 and they just kept getting pushed and pushed. And Hannigan's trying to book travel last week. He's like, oh shit, there's going to be a rail strike. We're going to have to do a lot of this by car.
And well, the good news is
the Queen dies.
Yeah, well, the good news is the Queen dying It means the rail strike isn't happening out of honor of her. The rail workers are going to work. So that, you know, there's good news and bad news there for you. But are you going to address the loss of that? You know, and I was worried as you were flying over. I was thinking, this moment we're recording this on the Friday, the day after the Queen died. And it's not entirely clear whether venues are going to stay open or close. So yeah. Are you worried about losing some of these amazing dates you have coming up in the UK?
I don't know if I'm more worried about losing the dates or just being stuck in throngs of hundreds of thousands of people while I'm trying to get to a hotel. I have no idea what's going to happen. I'm here. I showed up. I would have showed up during COVID if they didn't cancel the venues. I would have been here. I don't cancel gigs. They canceled gigs. So I'm here and I roll with the punches.
Good.
I don't. If you were going to ask, I have no material about the Queen. I really don't know how any of it works. If you're coming out, Doug Stanhope's going to... He'll have great material on this. No, I won't. If I had, I wouldn't hold back if I had a great joke. I just don't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you I'm tend to avoid those big, you know, I know you're not interested in doing jokes about Trump, which is because it's too obvious. Well, it's too big a subject. There's a great bit in one of your specials about how it's kind of ruined ruined the news for you because for 5 years, all the news has been Trump rather than all the funny stuff that you could pick up on usually.
Yeah. And I'm going further in that direction of right. Not talking. Well, because, you know, social media is ruined because everyone has an opinion now. Every comic that used to be talking about, you know, I have babies and they're like little drunk people or whatever. And now they're all, you know, sign this petition and vote on fucking SR 447 or like, where's it? You used to post GIFs of like a baby falling into a cake or something. There's no funny left. So yeah, I'm going the opposite direction of all that.
Sure. Well, I mean, what I love about your comedy, Doug, and I've been is you're very authentic and very committed to comedy. I was listening to your audiobook this week, Encore for the Donkey, and it sort of shows how dedicated you are to living the life. It's like for some comedians, myself included, probably I kind of wait for things to happen and hope I can make comedy out of those. But I think you sort of get in there and through your somewhat self-destructive lifestyle, things kind of happen to you quite a lot. It's almost like you're living the character, or the character is so much intrinsically part of you and the act. It's hard to divide them.
But yeah, that book was about one. It was a perfectly bookended year of everything going fucked up. So
yeah,
it was 2016, and since then, yeah, things have tempered quite a bit. Yeah.
Okay.
After the wife's coma, because it was the most beautiful excuse when she came home. She can't be overstimulated. She can't be around a lot of people. So it was a beautiful excuse to go, hey, we can't have these giant parties anymore. And football, we'll just get down to a handful of friends that actually watch football. It was the best excuse until COVID. And that was a way better excuse to not have fucking people around all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot, that book. It is, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, I think I do admire you, but it's hard not to slight the emotions it raises are also a little bit of, I mean, this is part of your act as well. There's sort of a bit of pity. There's a bit of fear for you. You know, you're very nihilistic. You're sort of unafraid of death or flirt with the idea of death. And, you know, so as a fan or as a reader of your stuff, it's a heady, it's good. I mean, it's what art should be. It's a heady mixture of you're this, you know, you're coming out with these amazing routines and brilliant ideas, but also, especially with that year 2016 where everything was fucking up and a lot of it
I've self-inflicted, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
That you kind of are worried that, I mean, you know, we're both 55 and that kind of lifestyle obviously was a few years ago. So you're in, approaching 50 maybe, is hard to sustain.
Yeah, and it gets boring. It starts to hurt. It takes a lot more time to recover, and you forget too much. Like, the more you live like that, you have to, you know, you don't. If it becomes fun, you don't remember it. So you're not even getting good stories out of it.
No. But, you know, a lot of your the stuff in your act, I watched The Dying of a Last Breed this morning, which is, again, you know, using your real life experiences. It is good for it's good for creating comedy. And I suppose it's your honesty. What I like about the book is I think as much as people who won't necessarily actually watch your stuff or who are not going to like your stuff might think you're, you know, shocking or offensive or whatever, I think the sort of the decency beneath it all, you're a very decent man. And what I like about the audio book, the book, is there's a few points where you are looking out for the, you know, for the ostracized people in society or the lonely people in society. I mean, it starts with you having a party on a boat and not letting any beautiful people get into the jacuzzi with you, only the ugly people who wouldn't usually be allowed to do that. So, and you know, that shows a sort of there's a heart behind your work that I think people, you know, might not want to see if they've decided what kind of comic you are. But you're a decent guy.
Yeah, I was always curious where people go, wow, it's so weird to meet you in person because I thought you'd be like a real asshole.
Yeah.
I never really see that coming through in my act. I mean, I yell a lot and I'll say something that might, you know, rub people the wrong way. But I always have an arguable point. If it is something controversial, there's some logic base to it. And then a fist fuck joke at the end, so I can call it comedy.
Absolutely for sure. Do you think that the problem? You know, I think with certainly like with there's a lot of sort of macho US comics, I think, and that maybe use offense just as a merely as a punchline, and they're not as sophisticated or thoughtful, I think, as comedians as you are sometimes. And I wonder if that's the reason that people start to think comedy shouldn't. I mean, you and I obviously believe comedy should be able to tackle any subject. There's a way of finding comedy in everything, and it doesn't. And it's not about if you do jokes about stuff that isn't that you're not taking it seriously or you don't care about it. But there's less good comedians than you, I think, can do offensive stuff just for the sake of being offensive. Which it never feels like your act is that.
I have two cousins. One who's religious zealot, right wing Republican, and then her younger sister, who is still kind of conservative, but a late outcoming lesbian, works with deaf kids. And I thought if either one of them came to my show and brought their friends, both of their friends, both the liberal and right wing, would find reason to be offended and leave. You're kind of a man without a country if you're pragmatic, and because people will hear one thing and go, oh, he's like this or he's like this. They would both find reason to say I was the other, where you can not have a side. It's okay to not have a side and just take every issue as it comes. But have you noticed that over here? Because I haven't been over here in a while, but since everything's like splitting into party lines, I don't even know if that's the biggest thing over here. I could name a fucking dozen American comics who used to just be comics, and now they've, because there's money in taking sides, so now their podcast is hardcore right wing or hardcore left wing, because if you get into a fight and pick a side, you're gonna sell way more tickets. And you know,
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely happening to an extent here as well. Yeah, and I think with audiences as well, that they only see the joke that's aimed at their side. So if you're and I think in the old day, I think you're right. I think if comedians, not, you know, there's no generalizations you can make about comedians, and not all, or at least they all fall apart. But a comedian should be able to take the piss out of everything, and should be looking to take the piss out of everything, and themselves, what they think themselves, and you know. And
I know a lot that are just calculated. Okay, I'm going to go full this way or full that way. And just, yeah, you know, it's, what are you, a fucking wrestler? You don't believe that. You just know it's going to make you money, and it's going to get your podcast noticed, and it's phony. And you're,
yeah, no, it's definitely phony. I mean, I was going to mention Jerry Sadovitz, who got into, who I think like is a comedian who is not, I don't know if you know Jerry, he's sort of equivalent to you to an extent, in that I think he is authentically living his life and his comedy hand in hand, and he sort of is horrible. He's not the same as you on stage, but he's horrible about everything. I mean, like to the extent that you watch it and some of it makes you feel sick. But I've heard about
him for years, and he's a bucket list comic. And then when, yeah, I read about what happened at Edinburgh,
yeah,
I know I sent out a tweet in his, on his behalf, in his, not in his defense, because I wasn't there, but I, and yeah, I've since heard that it was only this staff that complained about him. Actually, no one in the audience was offended or walked out, and it was the people that worked there that were bitching about it.
Yeah, I think that was the problem with young staff members who hadn't, you know, he's been going for 30 or 40 years, and, you know, the venue knew that. I think what's shocking about it is, well, A, is he's been sort of, the gig was, you know, stopped from saying we believe in free speech, but there's some things you can't say or whatever. It's like they had a list of things you're not allowed to say, but they hadn't shared the venue hadn't gone, by the way, if you say this word, you'll be taken off. So there's a secret list of some. And I suppose the problem is that you can hear a word and go, well, I think that's the way the world's become very sort of binary, is that people are waiting to hear a word to tick off a list rather than understand the intent behind it. With Jerry, he's the bottom of the pile, and he's fighting out everyone. I mean, and he lives the life, and whereas you might have had a party life, I feel Jerry's had a very unhappy life of being this guy sort of punching upwards at everyone. And so it would be weird in a way if he chose, you know, if he said, well, I'm going to go with everyone, but I'm going to not do any of the race stuff anymore, because that in itself, within his act, it would be almost sort of a racist thing to do. But also, you should be able to, you know, in art, you should be able to, I think people don't see comedy as art, and people don't see comedy as anything more than jokes. So when you're doing something a bit more complex, it's not just about, did you say the word or didn't, you know, did you say this word and then for you stop. So, but it's, yeah, I mean, there's a similarity. I mean, there's in the special I saw, you did a sort of complex routine about Indian call centers, which again is a subject that right-wing lazy comedians will go in a different way than you went, which is to go, why is everyone Indian? Which yours is much more complex, but gets in.
Well, yeah, no, it goes into, it's that that was the segue into Indian gang rape.
Yeah. So it's a complex routine, but it's the idea that you can't joke about anything. But that one is, you know, it's playing around with those perceptions, which, you know, again, I think intelligent comedy can do, and which I think you know, I mean, when you've been going as long as you have, you kind of hope that people would trust that you know what you're doing. But I suppose ultimately it's about people making their own choice about what they go to see. You're a comedian who, I suppose, if venues decided to cancel you, then you could be cancelled. But you can't really be cancelled because you've got nothing to be cancelled from apart from your podcast, yeah, well, and your live tours. Yeah,
I don't have no sponsors. When, you know, when comics in the States are getting cancelled, that means, oh, you get kicked off a TV show. But your stand-ups, Louis C.K. could have gone out the day after and sold out a room 10 times as big as I could sell out at the worst of his reputation. He could still do stand up. And when he did, yeah, people showed up.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think cancelling, I mean, it's weird when a gig gets stopped, but with Jerry, it's just meant he could go and play a much bigger venue than he would have ever got to play. So it's sort of, if you, and I'm sure Jerry wasn't being cynical about it, he's not that kind of guy, but, you know, you could cynically do this and go, okay, I can boost my career by going down this road. But, yeah.
What? Oh, Chris Rock, you know, with the slap.
Yeah.
Yeah, his tickets went through the roof. Any kind of controversy, and I do talk about this in my act, it's a cancel culture on some levels is good for business in our business.
I think you have to do something pretty extreme. You know, and I can't, I think, well, you in the book, you're friends with Roseanne, who's the person I think most of all has been most affected by being cancelled, and that she was kicked off her own TV show, which is pretty extreme. But I mean, I can't think of many people who.
But she can still go out and do stand up.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
People love her, and she is very funny. And when you look at her life, like all the things she's done for, you know, downtrodden people and victims of sexual abuse and everyone, she's just out of her fucking mind. I talk about her in the act too.
So tell us about the tour, Eddie. Well, let's talk about the tour. You're coming to a lot of cities in the UK. Having just turned off my phone and lost what they are. Is this all new material, or is it a mixture of
old shows? It's nothing I've done over here. Right. So, yeah, tomorrow I get a long day of trying to figure out, okay, what of the new stuff that I've been doing in the States, plus the stuff that I can't do over there anymore but want to do over here because I haven't done it, and how to segue it all together. Like, I have plenty of material. It's just now it's like a crossword puzzle of, okay, what goes with this? Because I've been doing it like this, but now I have to change it up, and then I have to go through, okay, when you think a bit's going to work, oh, this whole chunk of material will be fine over here. And then you go, wait, like three of the big laughs are references they're probably not going to get. So,
yeah.
And I took this summer off, and then I just did 3 weeks relearning what I was doing before I took the summer off. Did that in the States the whole time on stage thinking, okay, that reference is not going to work over there. They have Mad Libs. Do they know what Scooby-Doo is? And I'm completely in my head relearning what I have to do here that I'm going to learn how to do. It'll be perfect by the time I leave in 3 weeks. And then I'm going to have to go back to the States and unlearn it and relearn the other way.
Yeah. You've been here over here a lot, though. So you've got a better handle. And some US comics come across and just, you know, 20% of their act is like references to stuff that we're not going to get. Whereas most of those things you mentioned, I think we would understand. So you are aware of stuff. I guess over here you might be best known for the appearances on Charlie Brooker's Screenwrite show. That was a little while ago, but I was watching a couple of those this morning as well to remind myself of those. And those were lots of that was all that when it was because it was looking at America, wasn't it? An American culture as a correspondent.
Voice of America. I just found out not long ago from Hennigan, my manager, Black Charlie Brooker's show,
Black Mirror. Yeah.
Black Mirror. Yeah. They wanted me to play the judge in the first episode, which is by far the best episode ever of the pig fucking.
Right.
They wanted me to play the judge, and Hennigan, I would have had to stay longer on the tour, and I was so fucking tired of the tour that I just said no without even asking about it. And then later on, he goes, "Yeah, that's the thing you said no to." I'm like, oh, no. Damn it.
These missed opportunities that you don't do much. You occasionally crop up, and I know you don't really like sitcoms, but you did the Roseanne sitcom, didn't you? I think, and you occasionally crop up with little bits of acting. But is it something you're not? I mean, it feels like you're that stand up is your home and podcasts, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't like acting much. I did star in a movie that I technically starred in a movie, so that's why I did it. And I don't think you'll be seeing it in theaters, but
it sounds about the same as. That's about the same as my acting. I end up acting in lots of independent and weird little films. But yes, that's all good fun. I mean,
it was playing a 55-year-old alcoholic stand-up comedian who's chain smokes and is dying of liver failure, doing shitty gigs on the road in the States. And I'm like, all right, that's easy. And I have the month off anyway, so I'll go do it just for the experience, and hopefully I'll get some material out of it. It's low budget. Maybe it'll be the story value. And it was a fine time, which sucked, because I'm like, there's nothing funny in a fine time.
No, that's true.
So there's, I get no jokes out of it. And no. I don't know if it's going to suck. Like when you do stand up, you know in the moment if it sucks or not. You do a movie and it's all you. It's going to be a year and a half before you know if you suck.
Well, it depends how it all gets put together, but at least, I mean, I think the thing with stand-up in movies is you don't often see it done very well. It's very rare. So at least to have someone who is authentically can understand what that part is, that gives it some hope of being realistic and authentic.
Yeah, I rewrote half the movie as we were going.
Well, that's good. The last film I did was entirely improvised, which is absolutely the way to go. A, if your memory's not good, because I can never remember lines anymore, but also just then you can really put your creative input into stuff, and it's really good fun to do it that way. But
I'm shit at improvising. I still, if I say something spontaneous on stage that's funny, I clap like it's my first time on stage. I'm patting myself on the back inside. So it was a lot of rewrites, but improvising, especially with a camera on me.
Yeah, well, this was weird because it was because it was all improvised. It was sort of awkward to begin with, and then you get into it, and also it doesn't matter. You know, you're filming so much, it doesn't matter, and you reshoot. If something works, just reshoot and have another go at it. It was a really interesting way to work. I'd like to do more of it because it was creatively, it was very interesting. And then you don't have time to. My problem with acting is, you know, as a comedian, is you're kind of. I think you're sort of step outside and you're too aware to be a good actor. But if you're just in it, you haven't got time to think about acting, so you just get on with it. It was interesting.
Yeah,
it's
when you're supposed to shut up. That's when I have a problem with acting. Like, okay, you talk, then what do I do? Go grab a beer. I don't know what to do with myself while you're doing your line.
Well, it sounds in that film like that might not have been a problem, that you would probably be allowed to carry on talking if that's the character you are playing. Because comedians can talk. They can talk.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome. Like, what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let me ask you an emergency question. These are just some stupid questions I ask people every now and again. If you were going to be in a human centipede, Doug, where you're in the middle, but they let you choose the people at either end, who would you like in front of you and behind you in your human centipede?
Oh, wow.
Talking of improvisation.
You should submit these questions ahead of time so I have time to think.
I don't want you to think about it. I want a gut reaction, literally, in this case.
I guess I'd want a bulimic in the front.
Okay. That could work. Is there anyone you'd like to shit into the mouth of that you haven't already? Because having seen some of your work and listened to your book, there's a very good chance you've shat in people already.
I don't know. Who have I hated today, Brian? There's too many. I find myself just watching the news and just every person, I hate you. I fucking hate your face. And then the commercials come on and I fucking hate you. And then when you just hate that much in a row, you go, that's me. This is a problem with me. These people are not that.
Well, I'll give you one. I'll give you one from my own watching of TV over the last couple of days. I would like you to shit in the mouth of Nicholas Witchell. And that name won't mean anything to you. And you're a lucky man for not knowing it. But he's the royal correspondent at the BBC, who's a very obsequious, fawning guy who kind of waits for these moments, and then when they come up, he's center stage. And there was someone had a quote about the corgis. I don't think he said this yesterday, but he may have done, saying that they don't know the queen status and they still love her. It was something along those lines. But I think those corgis still get to look at other dogs and go, there's something going on here.
I want to burn a bridge ahead of time, but I think that bridge is going to burn. You know where I'm going, Hennigan? I'm supposed to do an interview with someone who's would be the back part of my human centipede.
All right.
But the interview's scheduled for the day after the funeral. So okay. There's no way they're going to fucking put Doug Stanhope, completely unknown comedian, on the day after the Queen's funeral.
But you might slip through.
Yeah, he would be. If that interview happens, I plan to figuratively shit in his mouth in the interview.
We'll look forward to it. That'd be good. So I'm kind of intrigued about I know you didn't like Hollywood very much, but what prompted you to move to Bisbee, which sounds like an amazing place from all your stories and from your books? But what made you decide to go to live in Bisbee?
Well, I did my 10-year stint in L.A., and I just couldn't live there anymore. There was no reason to. I just wanted to travel and, you know, go back to just doing comedy. I didn't want to audition for commercials anymore just because my agent told me I should. I would do so much shit in L.A. just because my agent said, oh, he said it. I didn't realize for a while you can say no.
Right.
Oh, I could say no to my agent? I thought I had to do everything you said. And so Bisbee was a town that I'd found driving in and out of L.A. to go out on the road. And it was I always love small towns. I live my life to avoid traffic, which is one of the main reasons I fucking hate the UK. I hate London. Just, it's claustrophobic. And the older I get, the more space I need. I feel like a 600-pound man when I'm walking down a street or getting in an elevator in the UK. So, yeah, it was a small town, but it wasn't like rednecky, stupid small town. And I loved it. And that's one of the things that quarantine spoiled me, is where I go, this is now I know this is what I want to do.
Right.
It's absolutely nothing. A small town. When you've been on the road for a while, I've lived there for 17 years now. At that point, 15 years. And it was the first time I'd stayed in my own bed in the same bed in my life since I was a teenager, like for a full year. Was turned into 18 months, but I'd never spent that. I knew where all my shit was. Like for the first time, the 15 years I had that house, I'd never like, I organized, you know, my Tupperware drawer. I had my closet organized and like, everything. I didn't know where my shit was. You get home and you dump your shit and you sprawl out on the couch for a few days and catch up on whatever shows are on your DVR and feed the whatever pets are still alive. And then go back out on the road. You don't really know where your shit is. And after a year and a half, I'm like, I love being a homeowner.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the same. But I think in the UK, touring is so different. I can't really get my head around what your life must be like doing a United States tour. And then, and because you play around the world so much that you really are just going from hotel to hotel so much of the time. Whereas I can get home from, you know, 50-60% of the gigs I do in the UK, I can still get home from.
Yeah, my tour manager drove the van from Bisbee, where we live, to our first gig in Michigan, and that took 5 days. I mean, they took their time just for him to meet me where I flew to meet him, and then we drove, you know, a couple thousand miles, and then yeah, I flew home just to unpack, repack for this, and then I'll fly back, and then we'll do another, you know, 5,000 miles through the Southeast back home when I get back. Yeah. So it's a lot of travel.
Do you think you can keep it up? Because that's what I haven't really toured. I did a tour of the podcast, but I haven't toured stand-up for a few years. And that's the thing that I really want to get back into stand-up, but the thing that puts me off is all the traveling. Do you think it's something you're going to be able to carry on doing for the next 5, 10, 15 years? Or is it going to come to a point where you go, right, I'm just staying at home? Because you're doing all your podcasts. You don't have to. You could just work from home.
Yeah. If I could set up a club at my house, which we do have kind of a club where we tape our podcast, the Funhouse. It's a standalone building on my property. It's 18 by 20, but we have a little tiny corner stage in it. And we filmed a couple specials in there where I can put 30 people in there, jam tight. But, you know, 30 people slammed into a room is a great audience. And I thought, what if I just had people come to me, like Vegas, and make an exclusive thing, vet them, like, put what the audience puts on comedians as far as trying to be the police. No, we're going to vet you to see if you're a good audience member. We're going to check your references. Go beyond the Dave Chappelle putting your cell phone in a bag. No, we're going to call references.
That's a good idea. I know you can do it. I'm sure you can do it. I mean, I like the bit in the special again where you addressed racists in your audience and told them that they were idiots if they were enjoying the material on the wrong level and didn't understand it. So that's the first step. You just tell them you're not welcome, and then you've got to pass a test to get in.
When people would say, well, you know, you mean it in a certain way, but other people might be laughing for the wrong reasons. Then yell at them for being fucking idiots. Don't blame me. I know what I'm talking about. Blame the people who are laughing wrong.
It's true. It is very much true. You talk about dying and you talk about, I mean, in the book again, you talk about the number of comedian friends you've had who die. And it seems to be something you're not worried about, with it, you know, you're not actively looking after your own health. I think would it be fair to say, or are you getting better in that regard?
No, I, when I'm at home, I'm really I eat healthy-ish. I mean, compared to the road,
yeah,
where you're just shoveling whatever fucking drive-through shit you can get in your head before showtime. Yeah, I eat healthy. I still smoke way too much. And I still drink, but I haven't done drugs. I've been doing edibles, which I think is really good. I was never a weed guy, but now they're legal and they're everywhere. It's just everyone has way too much weed because it became legal and people hoarded and now they're giving it away. So yeah, I dabble in edibles and I have fun writing when I'm high. Like actually writing being enjoyable as a process. I mean, a lot of the material that comes out of it is unusable, but I laugh my ass off at myself. Like I was writing out a set when I first came back from after COVID, after 18 months, and I got high by myself and I started on a yellow legal pad, just writing out a set. And after a while I'm writing in hecklers and then writing my response to hecklers that don't exist. And I'm laughing like this all by myself. I'm crying. And a few of the ideas actually worked, but just having the overall process of spending like 4 or 5 hours writing every detail of a set that doesn't exist.
But so, it's good because I think like I wouldn't do that, but I think the problem I have with writing is overcoming that, you know, actually that first splurge and everything. You just want to get as much stuff down and open up your brain and not worry if it's shit or if it's good and just see what comes out. So if you can actually create that mindset through artificial means, then I guess that's a good way of doing this, because you would, you know, if you're writing sober, you would write an equal amount of stuff that didn't work, I'm sure, and maybe less stuff that would work. Who knows?
Yeah. Right now, it's just a matter of, like, I have so many things that I've been doing in different ways. And now, again, it's just piecing together. Okay, how does that go into that? And fuck segues. And then I always have a notes in one pocket of just the shit that I did write high, that has no home or will never go anywhere, or is just silly, or that I'll just break that out. Okay, I'm at the end of this train of thought. Let's go to the high notes. I just pick randomly things that are stupid or just not worked out, and then move on from there.
And do you find, I mean, obviously you've found a way to self-medicate with alcohol that works, but because I had to stop drinking on stage when I was drinking because I just found it dulled my perceptions too much, or my reaction time wasn't good enough, or it just got too, occasionally I'd do a drug, you know, you do a club where the idea was to get drunk and it was sort of interesting, but it's actually quite hard to control the situation. Have you just got good at doing that with a drink in your hand, or are you kind of
drinking helps me in the opposite way. I just did for the first time, I did a full set in Detroit where I on an edible, and I got a little goofy, but it also, It reanimated all the things. The reasons I drink on stage are because otherwise I would be too focused on, oh, that lady's looking at her watch, and those people, they're on their phone. They're walking out. Are they walking out of my show, or are they just going to the restroom? All that stuff, I drink and I don't think about that. And then I can get into my set and, you know, act, perform. I'm not. Yeah. And then when I was high, what I did notice was, oh, I'm drinking and I'm high. And now I'm like, oh, that person just keeps talking to the person next to them. Am I running late? Like, just it brought all that shit back, all that kind of paranoia, inner workings. So, so far it's good for writing and it's good for fun. And it puts me in a way happier mindset off stage, but I'm not ready to go full bore edibles on stage. I'm going to stick with the cocktails.
Okay. And do you think you know, I've seen it said that you're only happy when you're sad. Do you think that's true about you, or is that just the character, or is that the real Doug Stanhope that's only happy when they're sad?
I love to complain, because that's really where most comedy comes from. I on this last tour, a friend of mine was spreading her father's ashes on all the highest points in all 50 states and saw that one of them was on. It's between your gigs. My dad loved you and he would mean so much if you would go on. It's just a 1 mile hike. Spread his ashes and it's the last state. And I said, yes. And I had the fucking, my tour manager and his wife and my opener all agreed to go. And this 1 mile hike, I go, what does hiking include fucking using your hands and knees? We're like climbing fucking mountains. Shit. Yeah, it's a mile, but it's a mile. I was bitching the entire time. But I go, oh, well, this is fantastic because I'm going to bitch about this on stage and have something new to complain about. And when you have something new to say right off the top of your act, it refreshes all the shit that you've been saying that you get tired of. So, yeah. I love to bitch.
Well, you've got to see, you say you don't like improvisation, but like in your life, it seems to me, you're very yes and, which is the heart of improvisation, that if someone says, do this, or can I do, you know, that you'll have a go, you know, I'm real life, I'm very reticent, and I think I'd miss out on lots of adventures, and adventures still happen to me, but it's very much against my will, which maybe is funny in a different way. But it feels with you that you'll take up challenges and you'll do stupid bets and you'll, if someone says, come and climb a mountain, you'll climb the mountain with them.
No, I agree. And that's one of the things I said that night. I only agreed to it because I didn't like her enough to say no. She's not that good of a friend. Like my good friends, people I'm comfortable with, I would have no problem going, yeah, fuck yourself. I'm not hiking up for a mile, even if it is on flat ground. But yeah, when you have to be polite to someone. No, I'm like you. I say no to almost everything. And that, right. Then after I get a good five or six minutes off the top of my set, I go, I have to do things I hate more often because it's business.
But, you know, it is a more, is that you'll get stuff by trying to create instance in that way, you'll get stuff that no other comedian will get. That's what I suppose is interesting. And that's, it always feels with your stuff, it's not, you know, I don't think I've ever seen anything you've done and gone, oh yeah, I've seen this done before, or I've seen it done this way before. You really managed to come, which is very hard, I think, as a comedian, to never kind of hit a hack idea or a hack subject. Or if you do hit a subject that might be hack, you're coming at it from a completely different angle, so it isn't.
You know, that last special you were talking about, there's a whole chunk about, you know, 2.5-star hotels versus 1-star. And it was, I know it was self-indulgent and probably it was not unique premises, but at some point you have to, like, this is shit that really bothers me that I need to say. And yeah, it wasn't really, I don't know.
But that was still different. That, even that was different. That's not the same. You're coming at it from, the character's so strong, the character of Doug Stanhope, which, you know, how much of it's you and how much of it's the artifice for stage is, you know, is obviously up for question. But the character's so strong and that even if you're looking at hotels, you're doing it in a way that, because you're talking about wanting to stay at 1-star hotels because the reviews are bad, because they give you clues about things that you'll want to do. It's a very Doug Stanhope routine that I don't think, if I did that, people go, well, you don't want to go and go to Hookers and go to a bar at 4 o'clock. So, you know, it's unstealable, I think, is probably the, if you've got an act, and comedians' act should be unstealable. You know, your act should be good enough that only you can really do it, I think, unless you're literally just a gag comedian, which is fine, and anyone could do gags. But if you're doing anything with a bit more depth to it than that.
That's why I'm unstealable, is my bits are 20 minutes long, and I'm doing them in a society where, you know, 30-second clips are as much as people can tolerate. No.
Well, you feel like a very British comedian to me, as American as you are, because of that, I suppose, in that... It is, you know, it feels like your shows are Edinburgh shows rather than even specials, you know, which often comedian specials are still just a collection of routines and jokes, but there's more to it than that. But maybe that's because you've been over here a little bit, or maybe that's just maybe the sensibility just chimes more than some American comedians for me. But I do know your stuff are better than a lot of the American stand-ups. But you do have this kind of very interesting life because you're living in Bisbee, but you were also hanging out at Johnny Depp's house. And, you know, it's this weird dichotomy of a life that you have.
It's not a regular thing.
No, but even for that to happen once, but you say it happens a few times to you, you know Johnny Depp, you're friends with Johnny Depp. So it's an interesting, you have experiences that other people wouldn't
I'm
have.
I'm pissing while we talk. I don't know if this is a first for your podcast, but...
It is. I was going to say, I was wondering if that's where you're going, but that's yeah. Okay. No, it's nice. That's all right.
I'm hitting the water just for the... but I'll hit the porcelain now. I just... For authenticity, yeah. I wanted to hit the water.
Yeah, it is the first, because I do too many over Zoom. I did all through lockdown, but nobody went to the toilet. If anyone did go to the toilet, they said, can I stop and go to the toilet? So it is a first. Thank you, Doug, for that at least. And there you go. We've got something that could no other comedian could do. It's on film, but luckily we only got the top half, so that's all right. Though I know that as a man who's exposed himself to Louis C.K., that's in a way you were getting the revenge in first there, and I think that was good for you. But you've been doing comedy since we'll wrap up soon. Well, you've been at the loo now.
Oh, no, I'm not in a hurry.
Okay, good.
Not anymore.
I'm always interested in the stuff that people did before they were comedians or when they were struggling to be comedians. And I noticed that you used to, I mean, you worked in telemarketing, right? But you also did gay sex lines. Is that true?
I did that one as a goof.
Right.
But before that, I did fraud telemarketing, borderline gray area fraud. Telemarketing. What's fun now? The guy that fired me from my last fraud telemarketing job in Vegas in 1989, I guess, is now the governor of Nevada, Steve Sisolak.
Okay. And what does it? How is something almost a fraud without being a fraud? What sort of things were you selling to people?
It was basically like you get phishing spam now. You won a big prize.
Right.
You're selling them like advertising specialties, like this, a pen with their company name on it. But because they were in, you're guaranteed to win one of these big prizes. And one of them's like, it's a trip for two to Hawaii. But what it is, it's a certificate that one person goes free and the other pays double, basically.
Okay.
So it's all in the wording of how you say it.
So he
ran one of the rooms, and now he's the governor of Nevada. I wrote about it. I wrote the whole thing in my first book, Digging Up Mother. And the specifics of the scam and him firing me, and now he's governor, and I'll occasionally tweet at him, "Hey Steve, you think you want to take me back to work your phone banks for your reelection campaign? Hello." Yeah, he's ignored me.
What a shame. He should get in touch with you. And what drew you? What drew you to comedy in the first place? Because you've basically been doing comedy since you were like 23, right? So
yeah.
What pushed, and you started in Las Vegas, what pushed you towards stand-up?
I wasn't like class clown, but I was like the funny, almost school shooter. I was the class clown, but my sense of humor was for a limited audience, just like it is now. I was always too dark for the room for class clown. I kind of horrified people. But I was always drawn to comedy. I always loved watching comedy. And when I was in Vegas and there was open mics everywhere, I used to go to one near my house and every Tuesday night and go, hey, if I write some material, can I go up next week? And then, yeah, sure. And it became a running joke. But after about the sixth time, I actually had 4 minutes and went up and did it. And did six open mics in my second week of comedy. That's how much comedy there was back then in 1990.
Yeah, I think it was similar in the UK, really. You know, we would I would sort of start. I started in about 1990, and there was you would go to a club, and then you would sometimes you could headline it the next week. It was kind of there was so much stuff going on,
but there were very few comics. I think that looking back. I would say there was probably a dozen open mic comics that would just do all the open mic nights. And now, you know, there's an open mic in Tucson, the closest city to me, that has an open mic once a week. And like 40, 50 people will sign up.
Yeah, it's definitely the same here. There's a lot of people who want to be comedians. I guess it was the same in America as it was in the UK, that it wasn't, you weren't really thinking this is going to lead to being a profitable career necessarily.
The same way you'd get drunk and dare someone to do karaoke.
Yeah.
All right, I could probably sing Joe Jackson. I can get away with some Joe Jackson. You're not going, oh, I'm going to be on America's Got Talent.
It's true. And another thing I liked about the book was, and again, I think this sort of possibly explains your style of comedy to people who don't think you should joke about these subjects, is you discuss the palliative nature of comedy. And it really, in the book, in this third or fourth of your books, the Encore for the Donkey, so many terrible things are happening and you're joking about them as they go along. But in order, there's, for some people, the worst thing in your life happens to you, and the best way to get through it is through laughter, right? Is that, I mean, I think that's, and that helps you cope with the situation.
Yeah, I don't think you go, oh, hey, hang on, we need comedy right now. I think it's just your natural default mode is to, and that's also when I laugh the most is when something's really fucked up.
Yeah.
I've laughed like this where my girlfriend's crying, and but you're so adorable when you're crying, and it just makes me laugh the more she starts crying about something dark. It's not a calculated, okay, we're going to need comedy.
But it is that, but but then also within the book, you're sort of cracking jokes as your partner is being taken to hospital, and it turns out to be an extremely life-threateningly dangerous situation that you don't see because you're off your nut a bit as well, that you don't really appreciate how serious it is, but
if I did understand that it was that serious, which eventually we did, and then we kept like a skunk never says, you know what? Maybe this is a wrong time for spraying. That's what they do.
So, look, let me take everyone through where your tour dates are, and that everyone should buy tickets on the 14th of September. You are also going to Australia next year, I should mention, but we'll just go through the UK coming up. 14th of September, you're in Newcastle. 15th, you're in Sheffield, O2 Academy. It's a big venue. 16th at the Manchester Apollo. O2 Apollo, 17th in Southampton. That's an odd choice out of all the places you could go to. You got a lot of fans in Southampton.
I have no idea what Hannigan tells me where we're going. I don't know.
Southampton, you're going all the big cities and Southampton, but it'll be all right. London on, I know one of these London dates is sold out. 19th, you're in London. I think there's an extra London date, isn't there? But I think that's sold out. And you're in Cardiff, St David's Hall, fantastic venue, 21st of September. Birmingham, 22nd, Glasgow, O2 Academy, 23rd, and Leeds on the 24th. It's a pretty full-on UK tour, and those are big, big venues.
I like Hennigan's very honest with me. He goes, well, Newcastle, we haven't sold a lot of tickets, but the good news is we're in a smaller venue than last time.
There's a lot of comedy fans in Newcastle. They'll come out for you. They're good guys in Newcastle. There's a lot of good comedy in Newcastle. Maybe not on a Wednesday night. I don't know.
We did this horrendous tour in 2012, just ill-fated 7 weeks of the UK.
Right.
At one point, they had rented us a double-decker tour bus that was last used for Lady Gaga's dancers. It was a 14 sleeping berth double decker tour bus. And like, it's me and the opening act. Somehow we had like five different managers or helpers. I'm like, what is going on? This is like how MC Hammer lost all his money. I don't know why, but I remember we played Newcastle was great. And, until we played Wolverhampton, Newcastle was my favorite football team.
Now it's
Wolves, even though we never go back to Wolverhampton. Point being, like 6 days later, we're playing Sunderland, and we played like a 2,000-seater with like 115 people in it. And they go, well, you just played Newcastle's right across the street. And I'm like, who's putting this tour together? So, yeah.
Anyway, but also that's the way that it's absolutely UK touring is so weird. That's fairly typical that you can sell out somewhere and then go. I mean, yeah, if it's nearby, there's a possible reason. Though Sunderland and Newcastle people will not go into each other's cities. So there's no reason why Sunderland shouldn't. They will not. They hate each other and they wouldn't be seen dead in each other's city. So I don't know what happened there. Don't know what happened in Sunderland. They don't deserve you.
Yeah, well, it's I'm not going back, as you can see.
And do you enjoy that? I mean, I've had a lot of gigs like that, and certainly, like when in the days we were in a double act that was on TV, we'd get booked into big venues, and 100 people would come. Do you enjoy those gigs, or is it too embarrassing? I find it quite embarrassing, but I think you'd overcome the embarrassment.
It's terrible because they weren't even sitting together. All right, two over here and four, 8 rows away. A couple in the back, you're like, all right. It can be funny, but on a 7 week tour of, I didn't know there's 7 weeks worth of cities in this whole block of islands.
I mean, there is, but you've got to start going small. You know, Southampton would be very cosmopolitan compared to the place you have to go on a 7 week tour. I mean, that's what, you know, that's sort of, I guess my tours are usually that 50 or 60 or 70 dates is what you sort of have to do to make it profitable at my level, but there we go. Look, Doug, it's lovely to see you, and I really massively appreciate you. I know you've just got off a plane, and you've stepped into a world where an old lady has died, and everyone's it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the next week.
Again, the more fucked up it is, the funnier it is.
I think the country is about to lose its mind. There's been plenty of things that we could have lost our mind over, but I think not having the Queen at that, she's like having a hand on the helm as we've been filling up with water. Now her hand is gone, we're probably
funny,
fucked.
It's funny you say that because 2-3 days ago, where my wife and I were watching the news, and they showed, I forget what it was, but the Queen was shaking someone's hand. And I paused the TV. I go, look at her hand. Because her hand was that old, like all black. Like when the old people get the, like, it's just a deep purple contusion. But that's what they look like all the time. I'm like, oh, look at the monkey paw. Ew. And then yesterday I go, guess who's dead, honey? Yep. And I'm flying over there right now.
I have a feeling she'd been on a drip, like she was seriously ill. She was meeting the Prime Minister, you need to do that for her to become Prime Minister. And I think they'd literally just taken her off the drip then put her back on it again. It probably killed her. I'm not saying the Prime Minister killed the Queen, but, you know, draw your own conclusions is what I would say. Look, it's been really lovely to talk to you. I won't hold you up anymore, just in case you feel like
I am glad to have shared this time together.
It's lovely to see you. And you know, if the new shows are anything like the stuff I've seen already, it's going to be, and I'm sure it is, it's going to be absolutely fantastic. So everyone go and see the wonderful Doug Stanhope. Maybe not if you're easily offended, but if you like good jokes, go and see Doug, who's one of the absolute top stand-up comedians in the world. Thank you very much. This is the end of the 24 series. We'll be back on Wednesday with the next one with Rhys Shearsmith, provided my shows don't get cancelled by the death of the Queen. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Doug Stanhope. Thank you to Scant Regard, who provide the music for these credits and do nothing else. The lazy people. I'm indebted to my director and friend, Chris Evans, not that one, who set up all of this, and to Doug's people, who did fantastic work in setting this up. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to GoFasterStripe.com and buy some downloads or books. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out, if you can. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends about this podcast. Make them listen too. Every new listener is another few tenths of a pence in the kitty. Thank you. Goodbye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.